Translation. If one says, and Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami is speaking himself here, if one says that Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita is full of Sanskrit verses and therefore not understandable by a common man, I reply that whatever I have described are the pastimes of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and that for me to satisfy everyone is not possible. Interesting, isn't it? Sometimes we try and satisfy everyone, don't we? Sometimes we try and be liked by everyone. Have you noticed that? We don't like it if one person in the world doesn't like us. Quite strange. Let's think how this verse is relevant to us. I'll read the purport. Srila Kaviraj Goswami and one who follows in his footsteps do not have to cater to the public. Their business is simply to satisfy the previous acharyas and describe the pastimes of the Lord. One who is able to understand can relish this exalted transcendental literature, which is actually not meant for ordinary persons like scholars and literary men. Generally, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's pastimes recorded in the Chaitanya Charitamrita are studied in universities and scholastic circles from a literary and historical point of view. But actually, Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita is not a subject matter for research workers or literary scholars. It is simply meant for those devotees who have dedicated their lives to the service of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. If one says that Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita is full of Sanskrit verses and therefore not understandable to a common man, I reply that what I have described are the pastimes of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and that for me to satisfy everyone is not possible. Om Agyana Timurandasya Jananjana Shalakaya Chakshiru Militang Jaina Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Vanchakalpa Tarubhischa Kripa Sindhu Bhavapa Petitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadha Shivasadi Gaura Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. I'm going to try and make this a little bit relevant to our own lives, and perhaps you've already thought of a few ideas of how this is relevant to us. First thing is, it's full of Sanskrit verses, and perhaps I think Kaviraj Krishnadas is referring to scholars. Generally, they would be the ones who would know Sanskrit. So we don't know Sanskrit verses, and he's pretty well saying, I don't care. Although I think probably there's a subtext here which is saying that actually we don't need to know necessarily Sanskrit in order to understand Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita. Secondly, we don't have to cater to the public, to their likes and dislikes. Although this raises an interesting question, I want to come to that. And thirdly, I think there is some kind of allusion to materialistic education here. The fact that Chaitanya Charitamrita is not understandable to mundane scholars and literary men. So we'll discuss a little bit about education here. Does anyone have anything else they want to say about what is relevant here before I move on? Anything else that you noticed? No? You're happy with that? Yes. Yeah, that's a very good point, actually. Even though I like that idea, there must have been a lot of critical scholars at the time. In other words, he was probably responding to something that was particular. So even though our shastras are teaching about the Sanatana Dharma, eternal truths and principles. The author, in this, authors are Vaishnava authors, in this case, Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami. They were also aware of the context in which they were speaking. And this is relevant to what we're going to be discussing. Because even though we may not cater to the likes and dislikes of the audience, there's another question here as to how much we consider the audience in preaching. And how is that relevant, for example, here in Bhaktivedanta Manor? You wanted to say something, Prabhu, please.
There are actually 270 verses from the Srimad Bhagavatam, which are supporting the supremacy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Lord Nityananda as the supreme personalities. So maybe that also could be like the scholars at that time disliked that, because he's using Bhagavatam, Amala Purana, to support that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is supreme personality of Godhead.
So he's quoting. Yes, 200, that's a good figure. 200, thank you. 270 verses. Actually, even that means that because he's quoting scripture, in a sense, he's following some kind of scholarly practice. Actually, my experience of studying in the outside world, and I do at the moment, is that actually sometimes the non-devotees are much more serious about referencing previous material than we are. Even though it does say in our shastras in the Bhagavad Gita that whenever we quote something, we should be able to give the reference. Now, that's in the Bhagavad Gita, and I don't know where it is. I'm sorry. But we should be able to quote. It is important. Just like a lawyer will actually quote from law books. There must be some evidence, some precedent. It is interesting. I heard one ISKCON, Shivaram Swami, he was actually giving a lecture, and he said, he was mentioning how we often talk about Srila Prabhupada's books being the law books for the next, 10,000 years. And he says, one generally doesn't read law books. I mean, who goes to bed at night reading a law book, unless you're perhaps an ambitious lawyer? We won't say anything more about lawyers. But generally, he says, you study these books. You don't just read them, you also study them. And I want to discuss this a little bit, because there's an important concept that actually we have in our tradition about education. There are many concepts, but there's one I'd like to focus on, and that is realization. But before we do that, I just want to look at issues of relevance a little bit. I often hear a complaint that we're watering down, or some devotees are watering down the tradition. We're diluting the message. We're compromising. There are big questions here about to whom are we going to preach? Are we actually reaching out just to the ethnic Hindu community? And are we reaching out adequately to the indigenous people, the British people? There's issues. Are there some issues here? I think there are some issues. To whom are we reaching out and teaching? There's also an interesting consideration about bridge preaching. Yeah? Have you heard the term bridge preaching? Who's heard the term bridge preaching? Yeah. You can put your hand up if you want. Yeah, bridge preaching, yes. My question to you is, what is not bridge preaching? What alternative metaphors have we got? There's an idea that bridge preaching, sometimes it's seen as good, it's positive, we're trying to reach out to people, help people cross the bridge. Other times, it's seen as perhaps second class. If it is second class, my question is, what is the first class preaching? What other metaphors are we going to choose? Perhaps it's a kind of time machine where you actually, as soon as you're initiated, and there's a sense that as soon as you're initiated, I've arrived. I've got a new name. It's almost an instantaneous process. Initiation means the beginning, to initiate. And our engagement with Krishna consciousness begins seriously at that stage. So my question is, what is this other kind of preaching? Because in actual fact, the path of spiritual life is not sudden. Those of you who are book distributors who've been on the marathon and others, you'll probably have met those who belong to another tradition who say that I was saved on such and such a day. Yeah? So there's an idea that it's immediate, and from then on, it's simply a matter of mercy. In our own tradition, there is a process, a journey, and also within Christianity, there are those, for example, who actually think that it's a pilgrimage. What's that famous book? Pilgrim's Progress. There's a journey. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, I'm going to ask that question. What is not bridge preaching? What is, you know, what do you mean by that? Mm-hmm. You might want to reply to me at some stage. But are these issues here? And sometimes the issue seems to be, are we emphasizing the ultimate goal or are we emphasizing the next step? Do we favor keeping everything as it is? Or are we more interested in change or reform? So we'll look at some of these issues here. I'd like to introduce that idea of realization, that concept, because that is very, very important in our outreach, in teaching, and in preserving the disciplic succession. There are many verses. I'm going to skip some of the ones I got because we're short of time. But there is a very important verse, or I consider this an important verse, that actually modifies a little bit our understanding of this statement, which is that we should not... What is that statement again? One who follows in his footsteps, that is Srila Kaviraj Goswami, they does not have to cater to the public. Mm-hmm. There's another verse I'd like to read. This is from the first canto of the Bhagavatam, chapter 4, verse 1. Personal realization does not mean that one should, out of vanity, attempt to show one's own learning by trying to surpass the previous acharya. He must have full confidence in the previous acharya, and at the same time, he must realize the subject matter so nicely that he can present the matter for the particular circumstances in a suitable manner. The original purpose of the text must be maintained. No obscure meaning should be screwed out of it, yet it should be presented in an interesting manner for the understanding of the audience. That is called realization. This is interesting. It's perhaps not just an explanation of realization. It almost seems to be like a definition of realization. There are other definitions, of course. There are verses in the Bhagavad Gita about the guru who is Tattvadarshi. Bhagavad Gita 4:34. Tattvadarshana, Tattvadarshi, means one directly perceives the truth. Pratyaksava gamam dharmyam, Bhagavad Gita 9:2, that this knowledge is the king of education, the most secret of all secrets. Why? Because it gives direct perception of the self by realization. Mm-hmm. Very important to understand what our epistemology is. The word epistemology means the science of knowing, how we know. Our philosophy does not totally deny the importance of the senses and of rationale. In fact, Anuman and Pratyaksha are actually one of the three main pramanas or sources of evidence. Rather, our process, And there are those, by the way, and some of the scientists have this idea, that knowledge and facts exist separate from the knower. It partly came about when they started to write books. So actually, when the writing process came in and the printing press was there, it started to separate knowledge, or that which is known, from the knower. For example, if I speak to someone and you try and convince me of something, or if you're speaking to me and teaching me, or even here as I'm with you now speaking, you're also looking at me, and I am very much involved in the process, as are you. Yeah. So they started to separate the knower or the observer from knowledge. And you've got some strange ideas in the academy. One of them that I'm going to address very briefly is that saying, and you may have heard it, the facts speak for themselves. Have you heard that? Now, two things. This is very often said by those who are interested in empirical knowledge, and they don't really like myth and metaphor and analogy and superstition. But this statement, then, the facts speak for themselves. Think about it. Two options we have. Either it's a metaphorical statement, the facts speak, it's a metaphor, in which case it's not consistent with some of the scientific method, particularly based on logical positivism. Otherwise, it must be a logical, for them, it must be, to be consistent, it must be a logical, literally true statement. The facts speak for themselves. In which case we can say, can you give me some evidence of a fact speaking for itself? Think about it. Have you seen it? I want some scientific evidence. I want to see a fact speaking for itself. It's nonsense. There was one book on, and it's related to evolution. I'm not quite sure what side of the fence it stood in relation to some of the debates on Darwinian evolution. But the title of the book is The Rocks Do Not Lie. The rocks don't lie. Well, the problem is the rocks don't speak. Do you understand? They're saying the evidence, and you'll find it in all fields. By the way, this phenomenon happens not only in a number of fields. So the scientists may point to the evidence. There's a lot of debate now about global warming. And although, I mean, personally, I think there probably is something called global warming, and there's a good chance, I think, that's my personal opinion, that maybe humans and industrialization has something to do with it. But sometimes the arguments put forward are really bad. I think there's one guy called Cox, and I remember seeing a video of him, and he got these graphs and he threw them on the table and said, the evidence is here, here it is. The point is, there is always evaluation of the evidence. Evidence does not stand by itself. Religious people are also guilty of it. I'm not saying this, Prabhu. Prabhupada's saying it. Nothing to do with me. You can't disagree with me because Prabhupada says it. The point is, all of us interpret. And by the way, we need to look at that word interpret, because Srila Prabhupada in cases said we shouldn't interpret. In other cases, he says that there is proper interpretation. He talks about the proper interpretation of Vishvanatha Chakravarti Thakur. All of us, in a sense, interpret. We see reality through our own mind and senses, our own concept of life. And the whole process, Ata Shri Krishna Namadi, Nabhavayad Graham Indre, Seva Mukhi Hijivado, Spayameva Sparachidaha. Only when the senses become purified by immersion in devotional service can we actually understand the pastimes of the Lord. So the soul, the self, has senses. It's not that the soul has no senses and the body and the mind have senses. That's not the fact. It is sentient, the self. The process is to purify the senses, to purify our perception, to purify our thinking and the intelligence also. Yeah? This is our very important to understand that. So we have a process. We have an epistemology. We have a theory of education. Now here, without a doubt, mundane education is being criticized. And I think there's good reason for it. Those of us who may have been involved with education will see that there are many problems at the moment. However, as much as we call modern education a slaughterhouse, and I think we need to understand what Srila Prabhupada meant when he called it a slaughterhouse in relationship to how it may be atmaha, it may kill the soul, kill the spirit, if you like, kill the spirit. Yes, that word spirit is interesting. When we know the soul, we have spirit. We're alive, yes? We know we're alive. Krishna consciousness doesn't mean we become dull. Jeev jago, jeev jago. We need to wake up. Isn't that true? We want to be awake, yeah. I know it's hard at this time in the morning sometimes. But actually, it's to see things as they are. Shastra chakshus. So actually, so let's get back to the point. I would like to finish soon. Even though we may not cater to the likes and dislikes of the students. And by the way, that is what's happening now in education. Why? Because universities have become business enterprises, market-led education. They've adopted the language of education. For example, students are now customers. Now, when that happens and you have to have customer service, then when the customers object to something, they will follow. That's not the business of a teacher. If you're a student and you say something, my business is not to agree with you. If you're wrong, I need to say, this is not Krishna conscious. Yeah? So they become customers. But actually, we do, this verse on realization suggests, we do need to take into account to whom we're speaking. But we don't cater to their likes and dislikes. We don't compromise. We stick to Krishna consciousness, but we present it in a way that will be accessible. I just want to finish. Well, let me see. There's an interesting verse here I'm going to read from the Mahabharata, which is far more, if you like, pointed. It focuses on this very nicely. Our theology is not vague. It's very specific. It has form. Let me see if I can find this for you. This is from the Mahabharata, Shanti Parva, section 321. It's a dialogue. It's an extract from a dialogue between King Janak, the ruler of Videha, and a woman who was a mendicant, a lady mendicant. Yeah, there were lady mendicants and lady gurus, possibly. Her name is Sulabha. She speaks of three things. The content of our speech, the words we use, which, of course, for us, should be based on Shastra. She talks about the speaker and the understanding and realization of the speaker. And she talks about the understanding or the level of understanding of the hearer. Yeah. This is interesting. I shall not tell thee anything prompted by desire, wrath, fear, cupidity. Cupidity means greed. Or abjectness. Abjectness means kind of like depression. Abject, when you're down, you're being down. Or by deceit, shame, compassion, or pride. So she actually then explains what happens if you don't do three things, if you don't consider these three items. The content, which would be according to Shastra. The other is actually my own understanding or realization or personal insight. And the third is the understanding of the listener. She doesn't explain what happens if I don't speak according to Shastra or the right content, because that's assumed. She focuses on the other two. When, in the matter of what is to be said, the speaker shows disregard for the understanding of the hearer by uttering words whose meaning is understood by himself, then, however good these words will be, and please listen, they become incapable of being seized by the hearer. In other words, unless the speaker actually is aware of the understanding, they won't be able to seize. Is that, you understand? Good. Great, thank you. Then, the other way around, that speaker, again, who abandoning all regard for his own meaning or realization, uses words that are excellent in sound and sense, he awakens only erroneous impressions in the mind of the hearer. That's interesting. Sometimes we do that. We speak on in a very technical way without really engaging with the subject. I recall many years ago sitting here on the asan and speaking about how bad sense gratification was and having the rather shocking and embarrassing realization that I wasn't really convinced about what I was speaking. Right? Perhaps it comes from the head, but it doesn't come from the heart. And this is the process. First, we memorize. I won't go into detail, but this is in Shastra. Second, we start to understand and we apply. And the third stage is that of realization, when it's not just a matter of the head, but it's fully assimilated knowledge. It's in the heart. Have you heard Srila Prabhupada speak? Wonderful. He just quotes verses like the flowing Ganges, but he relates it to his experience. It's him speaking, not someone else. It's not kind of divorced, a kind of what I call disembodied spirituality up there somewhere. Therefore, the guru is heavy, speaks with weight because he speaks with realization. We should speak according to our realization. The other thing I was going to mention, I'll be very, very quick, is that actually the purpose here is that when we speak, we are trying to please the spiritual master and all the previous acharyas. Very, very important. And we can meditate. By the way, I haven't had time to explain this, but there is a whole... in education, there is three main domains of education. There's knowledge, what we know. Who knows the other two? There's not just knowing, there's something else. Huh? Thank you, Jagpriya. Skills, which is, what's the verb associated with skills? The other one's values. So there's skills, there's knowledge, to know. The self is the knower and the doer. So skills, doing, and then values, which is about being, to be humble, to be clean. And by the way, non-devotee education talks about these three areas, although I will say they're a little ambivalent about values these days. The schools talk about values, but they rarely put them directly in the curriculum. For us, they're very, very important, because knowledge memorization goes towards understanding, and at the same time there's application, because as soon as you understand, you apply. An application of something helps you understand. As soon as you try and do it, you start to get some understanding. But the third stage is very important. It's not there in mundane education. I mean, there's kind of an idea, but it's not firmly a firm concept. In our tradition, that idea of direct perception, of full realization, is embedded very, very clearly. And at that stage, there is a focus on spontaneous application, just like when you're driving a car. When you're learning in the second stage, it's all this. You're wondering what you do. Oh, I've got to look out the windscreen. But once you can drive, then we could have a conversation about Guru Tattva and drive from here to Birmingham. Yeah, just, it comes naturally. And at that point, there's a focus on values. I'd like to read then the first of the seven purposes of ISKCON, because this is important. We may decry materialistic education, but it seems to me that actually we have a mission, a duty, a purpose, an aspiration to actually set up education that is actually exemplary. It is no good, Srila Prabhupada said in one place, our business isn't to criticize, it's just to add Krishna. So we need to actually have a better education, such an education, so good that others will come to us so that we can train them in that philosophy, that pedagogy, that epistemology. Yeah, that's what we need. But listen to this, the first of the seven purposes of ISKCON, to systematically propagate. Second word, to systematically propagate spiritual knowledge to society at large and to educate all people in the techniques, skills, the techniques of spiritual life in order to, three important words here, in order to check the imbalance of values in life and to achieve real unity and peace in the world. Very interesting. Several observations. We'll find knowledge, skills, and values are there. The purpose, in order to, is values, accompanied by realization and that kind of fluid application in our lives. Not just in the temple room. Yeah, everywhere. So that values is there. It's interesting also, it says unity and peace in the world. We're meant to have some impact on the world. Our business is not simply to, of course it's intelligent to want to get out of here. It's a pretty tough place at times. We do not deny moksha, liberation. A devotee will accept moksha, except the one type. But also our ultimate goal, as taught by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, was not that. Let me stay here, life after life. He is my Lord, birth after birth, we said this morning. Our job is to fulfill this mission, to actually leave a society that will enable people to themselves go back home to Godhead. And part of that is to build a system, a heritage of education, good education. We have a fantastic heritage. We have a whole parampara. We don't take initiation just from the spiritual master, but we have this whole heritage of scholarship. Rupa Goswami, Sanatan Goswami, Jiva Goswami, they were great scholars. They were very refined people, as well as being mendicants. We need to build, and therefore, I mean, today we've got, I think, a ceremony about the Haveli. We put a lot of energy into the temple. And that's right, because it's the home of the Lord. And we're very willing to put in funds. But we also need to, and I'm speaking to anyone who's listening now, those who actually have got wealth, they should also patronize education. By the way, this idea of education should pay for itself is ridiculous. It can never become a business. It then becomes it's taking on the quality of Vaishya qualities. Education should be supported. Okay, the Brahmins didn't take a wage, but they were given, the governors, the Kshatriyas, would actually sponsor, patronize education. They knew how important education was. You cannot have, and we cannot have, a successful Brahminical society without education. And let's actually accept that fully. Without a solid, authentic educational heritage and tradition, we will not push on this Krishna consciousness movement as we should. We might remain a little religion, that's okay. But those of us who want to really see Krishna consciousness more than just a small religion, I'm asking us, could we please not have this ambivalence about education? Because bhakti, the heart, it is true, is higher than the head. Yeah, that is true. But when you have bhakti, you do have jnana and vairagya. So if we really have bhakti, then we will actually take the time and undergo the austerity to set up an educational system for our own children, for adults, for devotees from cradle to grave. That is our duty. So I'd ask us, please consider this today. And thank you. I've gone on. Thank you for your attention. I've gone on rather long. We have 8 minutes for questions and answers. And try and put it as a question, even if you've got a comment to make.